This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Please join me in welcoming a role model for every generation and for the hope for this planet, Jane Goodall.
Thank you, Dee. Good evening to everybody. And after that wonderful welcome, let me return the welcome with the kind of call that I love to hear best in the world, and the sound you would hear if you came with me to Gombe National Park, the greeting call of the chimpanzee. Hello. There are just three, maybe four individuals that I want to single out as I go through this evening. And the first one, many of you know this, but my amazing mother. She was such a special mother. And she supported all my childhood passion for animals. Lots of little girls and little boys too love animals. They don't always have such an understanding mother as I had, although fortunately many people do. But when my mother found I'd taken earthworms to bed with me, She didn't get mad and throw them out. She just said quietly that they would die without the earth, so I helped her take them back to the earth. And when I disappeared for more than 4 hours on this amazing occasion, my first really vivid memory when I was 4.5 years old, and we went on a holiday to the country. So here's this animal-loving little girl from the city, where there's cats and dogs and pigeons and sparrows and not much else, now meeting cows, pigs, horses, sheep, face to face. No cruel battery farms and intensive farms in those days. Everybody was grazing out in the fields. And one of my jobs was to help collect the hens' eggs. I was getting them out of the nest boxes and putting them in my little basket. And, you know, here's the egg. But where on a hen was a hole big enough for that to come out? I looked and looked and couldn't see one. You wouldn't either. And apparently I was asking everybody, where does the egg come out? And obviously nobody told me to my satisfaction, so I decided I would have to find out for myself. And I remember this so well. I remember seeing a hen climbing up into the hen house where the nest boxes were around the outside, and I thought, she's going to lay an egg. And I followed her. Well, that was a mistake. Bok, 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 she flew out, probably terrified. So that wasn't a good place to wait, was it? That was a frightening place. No other hen would come in. I wouldn't find the answer to my question. I went into an empty hen house, and I waited. And that's why I was gone so long, because I waited and waited, and I waited and waited. And finally, as dusk was falling, my mother sees this excited little creature rushing towards the house, all covered in straw. And instead of getting mad at me for making them all scared and worried because nobody knew where I was, she saw my shining eyes and sat down to hear the wonderful story of how a hen lays an egg. So with hindsight, there you have the making of a little scientist. Curiosity, asking questions. You don't find the answer straight away. You think you will find out for yourself. You make a mistake. You don't give up, and you learn patience. It's all there. And my mother somehow was helping the development of this little scientist. She knew I'd learn to read more quickly if she gave me books that interested me. I wish some schools really would understand that. But at any rate, she gave me the books about Dr. Doolittle, so you must know Dr. Doolittle, even if you only know it from the movie. But Dr. Doolittle, the man who learned animal language, who was taught by his parrot, I wanted to learn animal language. For a long time, I pretended that I could understand. I translated the squirrels and birds to my friends, and they believed me. But then I found the books about Tarzan of the Apes. Not the movies, no Johnny Weissmuller had arrived in England. We're still in the middle of World War II. And so I found the books. And of course I fell in love with this glorious lord of the jungle. And what did he do? He married that other Jane. I was really jealous, and I felt I was sure I would have been a better mate for Tarzan. Don't you think so? Yes, I would have been. So that, when I was 11 years old, approximately, that was when I decided I was going to grow up, go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them. Not surprisingly, everybody laughed at me. As I said, it was World War II, and Africa was still thought of as the dark continent, very far away. No 727s and 747s going back and forth with tourists. We didn't know much about this dark continent. There were rumors of poisoned arrows and cannibals and things like that. But also all those wonderful animals. Biggest problem of all for me, no wonder people laughed. I was the wrong sex. Back then, girls didn't do that sort of thing. But the one person who never laughed at me was my mother. And she would say, Jane, if you really want something and you work hard and you take advantage of opportunity and you never give up, you will find a way. I have taken her message all around the world. When I've been talking to children in poor rural parts of Africa or in the inner cities. And because I was fortunate enough to have that kind of childhood and to face those kind of obstacles, I've had hundreds of letters from children saying, you've taught me that because you did it, I can do it too. So my mother's message goes around the world, and it's perhaps even more important now than it's ever been before. At any rate, when I left school, my friends went to college or university, but we couldn't afford it. And in those days, you couldn't get a scholarship unless you were good in a foreign language, and I wasn't. And so, again, it was my mother. She said, well, do a secretarial course, and then maybe you can get a job in Africa. That'll take you closer to what you want to do. So I did that. I was working in London. I had a letter from a school friend. She invited me to Kenya for a holiday. And yes, opportunity. Still no money. Give up the job in London. Can't save up money there. And go home. Live for free. No rent. Work in a hotel around the corner. And save up my wages and my tips. And eventually, and it took a long time because it was a sort of family hotel. People went for a week's holiday. After World War II, nobody had much money. So it took a long time to save up the wages and the tips. And eventually, I had enough for a return fare to Africa by boat, which was the cheapest in those days. So I was 23 when I waved goodbye to my family, my friends, and my country, and set off on this amazing adventure. And as I was saying to some of the students yesterday, for me, every day is like an adventure, because we never know what we're going to learn on any given day. We never know whom we're going to meet, or what opportunities we will get in that day. So, but that time, that was a real adventure. That was, you know, setting off on my own to go and stay with a friend. I couldn't even remember her that well. And when I got there, when I'd stayed with my friend, I got a job in Nairobi. You don't sponge on your friends, do you? Don't overstay your welcome. And I heard about the late Louis Leakey. He's the next person that I want to really discuss as one of my most powerful feathers. I went to see him at the Natural History Museum. He asked me all kinds of questions about the animals there. And because I had followed my mother's advice, because I had continued to read books about Africa and animals, because I had spent hours in the Natural History Museum in London, I could answer many of his questions. I was ready for this opportunity. And he gave me a job working as his assistant, his secretary, basically. And then he let me go with himself, his wife, and one other young English girl, and a few Kenyans, to a place that's now very famous, Olduvai Gorge, on the Serengeti Plains. And in those days, Olduvai Gorge wasn't famous at all because no human fossils had been found there. Only the fossilized remains of various animals. And all the animals were there back then, the giraffe and the zebra, the rhinos and the lions. Gillian and I were allowed out on the plains after the hard day of digging for fossils. And out there on the plains, sometimes we met a rhino. Once we met a young male lion. He followed us at least the length of this whatever this is. It's not an auditorium, it's an arena of some sort. And he was fully grown with little wisps of hair on his shoulders. And he was curious. He'd never seen anything like me and Gillian before. And it was a bit scary, but it was very exciting. And I think that's when Lewis decided that he would offer me this opportunity to go and learn not about any old animal, but about the animal more like us than any other. Of course I said yes, but it wasn't easy. It took a year before I could start on this amazing experience because, first of all, who was going to give money? I had no university degree. I'd just come straight from high school. I was English, and I was a girl. But eventually, a wealthy American businessman said to Lewis Leakey, okay, here's money for 6 months. We'll see how this young lady does. Second problem, the authorities of what was then Tanganyika, was a British protectorate, part of the British colonial system, is Tanzania today, independent Tanzania, having merged with Zanzibar. And the authorities had the same reaction. They refused to take responsibility for a young girl arriving on her own. But in the end, they said, oh, all right, if she has a companion. So who volunteered to come? That same amazing mother. She packed up in England. She could come for 4 months. It was a shoestring of an expedition. We had one ex-army tent that leaked. No fancy sewn-in ground sheets, but just a piece of canvas on the ground and the sides of the tent rolled up to let the air in, but also let in the spiders and the scorpions and the snakes. None of which she liked very much, but she never complained. And we had some tin cans to eat and a tin plate and a tin cup. And that was about it. I mean, how amazing, how many mothers would do that? And she did two things for me. One, in those days when I first began, the chimpanzees who are very conservative, who had never seen a white ape before, took one look at me and vanished into the undergrowth. And I would get back depressed, because I knew if I didn't see something exciting before the money ran out, that would be the end. No more study. I would have let Lewis Leakey down. But there was Mum in the evening, and I never got back till it was just about dark. So she had a lonely life. But I would get back. We'd share our simple supper of tinned food. And she would point out what I had learned. She'd point out that I was learning the foods the chimpanzees were eating, that I saw how they made a platform or nest of branches up in the trees each night. I was seeing the beginnings of an understanding of their social structure, where they move around sometimes in small groups, sometimes singly, sometimes small groups meeting up into a large gathering, continual coming and going within this community. And so she really boosted my morale. And the other thing that she did, she started a clinic. She wasn't a doctor or a nurse, but she cared about people. And her brother was a doctor. And so we had all these simple medications like aspirins and bandages. And some of you may remember Epsom salts and saline drips when you mix salt and water and drip it on a wound. She made some amazing cures. She became known, I found out later, as a white witch doctor because she practiced white medicine. So she established for me an amazing relationship with all the local people, and that has stood us in good stead ever since. So I was really sad that she left just before the breakthrough observation. And I can never forget that day in 1960, about 5 months into the study, when I was walking back through the vegetation. It had been raining. I was wet and cold. And I suddenly saw a dark shape hunched over a termite mound. And I stopped and I peered with my binoculars and I saw a hand reach out and pick a piece of grass. And I could see that a chimpanzee was using this as a tool, pushing it down into the termite mound, into the passage of the termites, waiting for a moment, pulling it out, picking the termites off with his lips. And then I saw him pick a leafy twig and strip the leaves. So why was this so exciting? This chimpanzee, the one I'd come to know and named David Greybeard for his white beard, the one who had been the first to begin to lose his fear of me, he was using a tool. He was making a tool by modifying an object. And this was exciting because at that time, it was thought that using and making tools differentiated us more than anything else from the rest of the animal kingdom. So we were known as man the toolmaker. And when I sent a telegram to Louis Leakey, the reply came back, now we must redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans. So that observation of David Greybeard using tools was a real red letter day. I would love to have shared it with my mother, but she'd gone. And David Greybeard is the third of the individuals that I want to specially mention. Not only did he demonstrate tool using, and a little bit later, the fact that chimpanzees hunt for prey sometimes and share the carcass, but also because he lost his fear, and when I appeared in a group that was ready to run, and he sat there calmly looking at me, the others with big wide eyes looked from him to me, and, well, she's not so frightening after all. So really, David helped me to move through a doorway into a magic world, the world of the wild chimpanzees. And wasn't I lucky to be the first person to really explore that world in depth? So looking back now over nearly 50 years, in 2010, we will have the 50th anniversary of the time when I first began in Gombe National Park in Tanzania. That's amazing. That's the longest unbroken study of any group of wild animals in the world. And we're still there, and we're still learning things. And looking over this half century of knowledge and exploration, what do we find that's really, really fascinating? So much, but I think above all, we are amazed at how like us chimpanzees actually are. Biologically, the DNA of chimps and humans differs by only just over 1%. The blood of a chimpanzee is so like ours, you could have a blood transfusion if you matched the blood group. You could not from a gorilla. Chimpanzees biologically are more like us than gorillas. The immune system so similar that they can catch or be infected with all known human contagious diseases. And then, really fascinating, the brain. The brain of the chimpanzees, is so like ours that the main difference is in its size. And shouldn't surprise us then that they're capable of intellectual abilities that we used to think unique to us. One by one, many of those attributes that were supposed to mark us as separate and unique have been broken down through observations of chimpanzees and other amazing animals as well. We can really push to discover the limits of chimpanzee intelligence in captive situations where chimpanzees can be rewarded. It's like sending children to school and encouraging them to learn. Their brain will develop faster than if they were just staying forever with no school out in the forests. And captive chimpanzees can learn American Sign Language, which is being demonstrated down here on the floor. They can learn about 400 of these signs of American Sign Language. And they can use them to communicate with each other, although they prefer to use their own postures and gestures, as well as with their teacher. And in many other ways, in the wild, we discover them using this amazing intellect, particularly as they manipulate each other in social situations. So there they are, these amazing chimpanzees, with their similarities to us and their intellectual abilities, so like ours. Their own postures and gestures, kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another on the back, swaggering, shaking a fist, throwing a rock, laughing, tickling each other. They do these things in the same kind of context we do, and they clearly mean the same kind of thing. The chimpanzees have a long childhood. The mother has her first baby when she's 12 or 13. She then has one child every 5 or 6 years. That's a long period during which the child is riding on the mother's back, sleeping with her at night, and suckling, although after 3 years, the child no longer depends on milk, but still suckles for reassurance. And we think that this long childhood is important for chimpanzees as it is for us, because they, like us, have a lot to learn. And we find that as the brain gets more complex during evolution, so learning in an individual's life plays an ever more important role in acquiring adult behavior. And the young child has a lot to learn, the different personalities of the other individuals in the community. And they are as different one from the other as we are. And the child must learn which of his playmates has a mother who is more dominant than his own, so that if he accidentally hurts a child in play, and the mother of the other may attack him, hit him, punish him, and then his mother may get attacked as well. So there's all these things that they have to learn. But they also learn things like tool-using behavior. There's 8 different ways in which chimpanzees use objects as tools at Gombe alone. And in every place in Africa where chimpanzees now have been studied, they use different objects for different purposes. And because it's very clear that the young ones are learning by observing the adults and imitating and practicing, that's one definition of human culture, behavior that's passed from one generation to the next through observational learning. So we can say that chimpanzees have their own primitive cultures. It was fascinating for me over the years to see, to watch the development of the relationship between the mother and her offspring, to see how during these 5 years when the child is totally dependent for transport and food, for learning, the bonds get stronger and stronger. And then when the new baby is born, the older child doesn't leave. The older child remains emotionally dependent on the mother. And so the bonds get stronger and bonds develop between brothers and sisters. The male, the father, well, until very recently with new methods which enables us to do DNA profiling from fecal samples, now we know for sure who the fathers are. But before that, because there's no long-term bond between non-related adult males and females, we could only guess who was the father of which infant. I think we guessed pretty well, but we weren't sure. Now we know. We can look to see if there's any special relationship between a male and his biological child, even though I don't quite see how there could be. We can now look. So it was a shock when I first realized that chimpanzees, like us, had a dark side to their nature, that particularly in interactions between neighboring social groups, neighboring communities, there can be very brutal and violent behavior, that groups of males patrolling the boundary of their territory, if they see strangers from a neighboring group, may give chase, may attack, may leave victims to die of wounds inflicted. And as I say, this was a shock. But we can take comfort from the fact that they show also precursors of love and compassion. They can show true altruism. A couple of stories here. First of all, imagine that you're with me and we're walking through a forest. And it's lovely and dim and green under the canopy with little specks of sunlight dancing down. And we're following a male called Satan in his prime. He's not very wicked, but when he was a kid, he stole a manuscript from my mother, who'd come on a visit. We had to bribe him with a banana to get it back. But that was long ago. And now here he is, 23 years old, in his prime, very magnificent. And suddenly, he hears sounds of an excited group of chimpanzees feeding in the trees ahead. Can you imagine about 20 making sounds rather like this? Sort of like that. So Satan is now all excited. His hair bristles. He hurries along the trail. He comes to this big tree filled with ripe fruit and feeding chimpanzees, he rushes up. There's a bunch of red figs, delicious, over there. He goes straight there. Well, there's a younger male, about 2 years younger than Satan, feeding there, but Satan is dominant, threatens that younger male away, and begins to feed. The young male starts screaming. There's a special call they give. It's a call for help, and this is a screaming for help because, unknown to Satan, that young male's older brother is feeding higher up in the tree. And now, hearing his kid brother in trouble, he's about 3 years older than Satan. He comes swinging down. The two brothers attack Satan together. Now Satan screams. To my amazement, a very old female, whose teeth are worn to the gums, who's shriveled with age, who weighs about half each of these battling males, who's probably closer to 60 than 50 years old. She's been feeding quietly in the canopy. She comes swinging down. She drops her frail little self onto these three males, and with her little fist starts hitting at the two males. And I think they were so surprised, they mildly threatened her, and Satan got away. And that was Satan's old mother, Sprout. When a mother dies, her older child may care for an infant. If the infant is over 3 years old, it has a good chance of surviving. If there's an older brother or sister, who will look after that child? One little infant, 3.5 years old, little Mel, when he died, he had no older brother or sister. He was alone in the world. And to our amazement, a 12-year-old adolescent male adopted him, waited for him in travel, let little Mel ride on his back. If Mel begged for food, Spindle would share. If Mel crept up when he'd made his nest at night, Spindle would draw him close and they would sleep curled up together. And he would even rescue little Mel if he got too close to socially roused males when they're competing for dominance and charging across the ground with bristling hair. If an infant gets in the way, they may actually pick it up and throw it. It seems they lose their inhibitions. And a mother's job is to keep the child away. And Spindle took that job on as well and saved Mel's life. So these amazing beings have really and truly helped us to blur the line that once was thought to be so sharp, dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. They force us to admit that we humans are not the only beings on this planet with personalities, minds, and feelings, which causes us to show new respect, not only for the chimpanzees, but the other amazing animals with whom we share this planet. And back in 1960, when I began, it was very different. And when I got to Cambridge, I was told I'd done everything wrong, Cambridge University, because Lewis said I had to get a PhD. We didn't have time for a BA, he said. And so I was a little bit nervous, you can imagine. And to be told I'd done everything wrong, that I should have numbered the chimps, naming them wasn't scientific, I couldn't talk about them having personalities or minds or feelings because those were unique to us. But fortunately, I thought back to a teacher I had as a child, a teacher who taught me absolutely animals do have personalities and minds and feelings, so that I was able to have the courage of my convictions in spite of these erudite professors. And that teacher, the teacher many of you are familiar with, was my dog, Rusty. So here's the fourth individual that I especially want to recognize, because he really did help me to stand up for what I thought was right and learn how to express myself in scientific terms without exposing myself to be torn apart by other scientists who didn't like the way I did things. And it was my supervisor, Robert Hind, another very special person who helped me to do that. So it's a bit sad to find that chimpanzees, who really have been like ambassadors from the animal kingdom to us, are vanishing in the wild. They're becoming extinct like so many other animals around the world today. They're disappearing because of the destruction of their habitat, ever-growing human populations. They're disappearing because they're being hunted for food, not to feed hungry people, but because of the bushmeat trade. The bushmeat trade is the commercial hunting of wild animals for food. And it's going on unchecked, more or less, in the Great Congo Basin, the last stronghold of the African great apes, the gorillas and the chimpanzees and the little bonobos. And it's a totally unsustainable practice, and JGI is doing what it can to do something about it. But even the Gombe chimpanzees are endangered. When I flew over the area about 16 years ago and looked down from a small plane, I was absolutely shocked to see the extent to which the habitat outside the 30-square-mile park, it's tiny, just 30 square miles, of beautiful forest with crystal-clear streams running down to the water of Lake Tanganyika. And outside, all the trees had gone. And this is steep, hilly country, so as the trees went, so there was terrible soil erosion, so the soil, thin layer of topsoil, being washed down into the lake. There were more people clearly living on this landscape than it could possibly support, not just from typical population growth, but also from refugees coming in from Burundi and over the lake from eastern Congo. So the question that came into my mind as I flew over is, how can we even try to protect these famous chimpanzees if the people living around them are struggling to survive? And that's what led to our JGI Take Care program, TACARE, which is a very holistic effort to improve the lives of the people living in the villages around the Gombe National Park, starting with Tanzanians that we employed, going into the villages and listening to the elders and asking them what they felt would improve their lives, what would make things better for them. It was health, and it was education of their children. So that's how we began. And then we gradually introduced the other elements of the program which we felt would be most helpful, farming methods most suitable to the steep eroded land, ways of reclaiming overused farmland so that within 2 years it can be productive again, working with groups of women, giving them opportunities to take out tiny loans, the microcredit system, based on the Grameen Bank of Muhammad Yunus, who is one of my all-time heroes. And so we also provide scholarships for gifted for girls to stay in school beyond the primary level. And we provide information about family planning and HIV/AIDS. And we work a lot with women because all around the world it's been shown that as women's education improves, family size drops. And we work very hard to ensure that the projects that result from these tiny loans from the microcredit banks are environmentally sustainable. So gradually, the people in the surrounding villages, and we started with an EU grant for 12 villages, and now we're working with a great deal of money from USAID, United States Agency for Development, in 32 villages. And we've expanded to provide better hygiene, wells are being dug, school rooms are being added, all kinds of things that we can do because other money is coming in, and it's coming into the Take Care program. Most recent piece of this puzzle, we found in the high hills very good coffee is grown, and the farmers couldn't afford to get it to market because there's no proper roads. So we persuaded coffee roasters, starting off with Green Mountain coffee roasters, to come to test the coffee. They pronounced it excellent, and now there is a specialty coffee, Gombe Reserve, sold by Green Mountain, and it has the seal on it, good for all. And because of this, because the farmers are now getting better money than they've ever had before, and because there is a commitment that this kind of money will be theirs every year, it means that now some of the villages are offering between 10 and 20% of their land to regenerate. Within 5 years, a seemingly dead tree stump can regenerate into a 30-foot tree. That's how resilient the soil is. And because they have woodlots near the center of the village for the women, they don't have to go climbing up, hacking at these dead tree stumps for firewood. And so these little Take Care forests that are beginning to grow is the one hope for the Gombe chimpanzees for a sustainable future, because they must be able to move out as they used to and interact and increase their gene pool with other remnant chimpanzee groups. So we're trying to develop the whole area. We call it the Greater Gombe Ecosystem. One of the things that we've done in these villages is to introduce our youth program, Roots and Shoots. How did this begin? Well, it began because when I realized what was going on with chimpanzees, how they were vanishing right across Africa, when I was at a big conference in 1986, I realized that I had to stop living this lovely dream life I was living, working in the forest, learning about these amazing beings, doing some research, some writing up, some lecturing. I had to stop and go out and talk about what was going on and raise awareness. And then I found, as I was traveling around in Africa, in the range countries, of course I began to find out what was actually going on in Africa. I began to have a sense of the degradation of the environment and the problems faced by the people living in Africa, the deforestation leading to soil erosion, leading to desertification, leading to loss of biodiversity, leading to huge problems for the people living there, who began to become increasingly living in a vicious cycle of poverty and overpopulation, hunger and disease. And I began to learn more about the ethnic violence as well. And I began to realize that the environment is being destroyed in two ways today. One, by very poor people who simply destroy the environment because they've got to find some way to get through from day to day to day to feed their families. And they may have to cut down trees to grow crops, or they may have to have goats who destroy the environment because they have to care for their families. And they know perfectly well that they're going to change what may start off as lush forest into a desert. But what else can they do? And then on the other hand, you have the unsustainable lifestyles of the elite communities around the world, and we take far more than our fair share of non-renewable natural resources. So I thought, well, then I must start traveling outside Africa. And going around in Europe and North America and increasingly in Asia, all the different pieces of what we are doing to harm the planet began to lay themselves out as an interconnected whole. And it became more and more distressing. The pollution. We're poisoning the air, the water, and the land. We're still using synthetic chemicals. We still don't know the long-term cumulative effect of many of them. We have children being born in environments where the air they breathe, the water they drink, the food they eat is actually making them sick. We are burning up fossil fuel in a greedy and ridiculous way, adding to the greenhouse gases, which is leading to climate change. Water is a huge problem. As you know, water, the surface water is shrinking, the water tables are dropping, the great aquifers are becoming endangered, and all is becoming polluted, and this pollution is washing down with the rain into the streams, the rivers, the lakes, and the sea. The fish that we eat are becoming contaminated as well as being overfished. We're eating more and more meat. That means that animals are being farmed not only in an inhumane way, but in these intensive farms where to keep them alive, they must be fed antibiotics routinely so the bacteria are building up resistance and so superbugs are being developed there. And in fact, the intensive farms are the second biggest polluters and creation of greenhouse gases on the planet. And as more people around the world get more money and want more meat, what is going to happen? E.O. Wilson has commented that if the entire population of the planet today was to attain the average standard of living, well, the standard of living of the average American and European, we would need three new planets. That was about 6 years ago. Now it's estimated we need five or even six new planets. But it doesn't actually matter, does it, whether we need three, five, or six, because we don't even have one new planet. We've got this one. So what's gone wrong? And if you think back to to what I was saying about chimpanzees, how like us they are. But we are different, aren't we? Look at us gathered together in this stadium. Look at the fact that we've sent people to the moon. Look at the amazing advances in medical technology. Look at what we have done with our amazingly developed intellect. And what is it that has caused this development of the intellect, the explosion of the human intellect? I believe it's because at some point in our evolutionary history, we developed a spoken language so that we can teach about things that aren't present, we can remember from the past, we can develop history, oral then written, we can plan for the distant future, and we can have a discussion where people with different life experiences can gather together and talk about an issue and try to resolve it. Brainstorming, we call it. All these things we've done. We're arguably the most intellectual creature that's ever walked on the planet. So how come we're destroying our only home? And do you think it's because we've lost something called wisdom? The wisdom of the indigenous people who would gather together to make a major decision and ask, how will the decision we make today affect our people 7 generations ahead? And how do we make decisions today based on how will this affect me or me and my family now? How will this affect the next shareholders meeting 3 months ahead? How will this affect my next political campaign? These are the kinds of criteria that we're using to base our decisions on today. And losing wisdom, is there perhaps a disconnect between this very clever brain and the human heart, the seat of love and compassion? I think if we don't have a grounding in this humane part of us, we create a very dangerous animal indeed, the animal that can go out and make weapons of mass destruction and kill others far away by pressing a button, and can destroy the environment for the sake of to the detriment of the children of the future. Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, has certainly raised awareness about climate change right around the world. There's hugely more awareness now. But I still remember going to the Millennium Peace Summit for religious and spiritual leaders in the United Nations. And almost none of the 1,000 religious and spiritual leaders from 100 countries addressed the environment. But one group did, and it was the indigenous people from 9 countries. And as they stood there, united, in front of the assembly, which was now filled with religious and spiritual leaders, the leader of the Eskimo nation of Greenland, or, well, he calls himself an Eskimo. It's not politically correct, but uncle calls himself an Eskimo. And he stood there, and he said, "My brothers and sisters, I bring you a message from your brothers and sisters in the north. Up in the north, the ice is melting. What will it take to melt the ice in the human heart?" No wonder, as I began traveling around the world, I met so many young people, high school students, university students, young people who were out there in the big world with their first jobs. So many of them seemed to have lost hope for the future. And they were depressed, they were apathetic, some of them were angry. And when I talked to them, they more or less said the same thing. "We feel this way because we feel that you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it." We have compromised the future of our young people today. I've got 3 little grandchildren. I think how we've harmed the planet since I was their age, and I feel a kind of desperation. But it's not right that there's nothing we can do about it. There is a lot. And this is what led to the Roots and Shoots program, which began in Tanzania in 91 and is now in 98 countries around the world with close to 9,000 active groups with members from preschool right the way up kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and right on up to and past university. So we're in refugee camps and prisons and retirement homes and so forth. Roots and shoots. Imagine an acorn. Little roots come out. A little shoot comes out. How small that looks. But there is so much energy, so much life force in that seed that those little roots can push their way through boulders to reach the water, and that little shoot can work its way through crevices in a brick wall to reach the sun, until the boulders and the brick walls, all the problems we've inflicted on the planet, are dispersed. The most important message: every one of us makes a difference every day. And if we would just spend a little bit of time thinking about the consequences of the choices we make each day, what we buy, what we wear, what we eat, there's so much we can do. And collectively, that will start to make bigger and bigger changes as more and more people understand that their own life does make a difference. I meet so many people who think about the problems of the world, feel helpless and hopeless, feel that there's nothing they can do as one person, and so do nothing. But as people begin to work together, making these small, correct decisions, thinking about what they can do to reduce their own ecological footprint, we start to see the changes that we must have. And kids get this. They really do. What do the Roots and Shoots groups do? They choose themselves. It's youth-driven. And even quite small children have a jolly good idea of what they want to do. So in a group, they will sit around and talk about the local problems, decide which ones they care about and often care passionately about, and choose projects that they can take action. And one kind of project will help animals, including domestic animals. One kind of project will help people, and one kind of project will help the environment. And running throughout is a theme of learning to live in peace and harmony, and to break down the walls that we build between people of different nations, different cultures, different religions, and between us and the natural world. Kofi Annan made me a messenger of peace because I explained Roots and Shoots to him and said, wherever we go, we are sowing seeds of global peace. The United Nations has an International Peace Day, and I had never heard of it. Most people hadn't. So, do we have a peace dove back there? Or not? Yes. Okay, so one of our Roots and Shoots members made a giant peace dove, first to commemorate my being made a messenger of peace, and then I decided we would fly these around the world. We would get communities together to make them, and then to fly them on the UN International Day of Peace, which is on the 21st of September. So we've brought one to show you, because this year we want to fly these doves in 100 countries. We want to vision a world of peace and harmony. And one of my wonderful friends who writes songs wrote a special song for Peace Day. If it works, the dove will proceed up the middle and the song will play. If the song does play, listen. Listen to the words.
Giant 20-foot wings of fabric that are handmade by everyone. Once a year we circle the world, saying, ain't it time to bury the guns? Our time has come, and we have begun to circle the world. It's a dream and it's a vision, it's a prayer that we may see. When every person, every creature will be treated with dignity. When every war will be a memory we never shall repeat. Our time has come, have begun to circle the world. What if we could circle the world, flying peace doves beneath the sun? Giant 20-foot wings of fabric that are handmade by everyone. Once a year we circle the world, saying, ain't it time to bury the guns? Our time has come, and we have begun to circle the world.
So last year, I was with 48 giant peace doves in Griffith Park in Los Angeles. We also have flown doves here in San Diego. And there's something very magical about being with a parade of these giant peace doves. And thank you. Thank you, peace paraders. So the last thing I want to say, everywhere I go, people ask me, Dr. Jane, do you really have hope for the future? You've written a book called Reason for Hope. You give talks called Reason for Hope. But think, they say, what you've seen the forests going in Africa, you've seen the chimpanzees decrease in numbers, you've seen terrible examples of man's inhumanity to man and man's inhumanity to the fellow animals on the planet. Do you really have hope? Well, my four reasons for hope are very simplistic, probably very naive, but they work for me. And the first one is these young people, the Roots and Shoots and other similar youth around the planet. Some of the groups of Roots and Shoots are doing extraordinary things. And sometimes it's requiring a lot of courage. In Nepal, groups of Roots and Shoots are taking turns to go into Maoist rebel-held territory, they were, and teaching reading and writing to the children in the untouchable caste there who are being forced to work in the coal mines. The only way they can get out of this situation is to get educated. How would that be? So these young people are risking their lives to go and try and help them to do that. And then there are groups that work for 3, 4, 5, 6 years on a project, like removing the exotic plants from wetland or from a piece of prairie to restore the environment to how it once was. A group here working on the Channel Island foxes to restore those islands to something like they were before. So that's one of my great reasons for hope, is the determination, the enthusiasm, the energy, the commitment, and the courage of young people all around the world when they know what the problems are and they are empowered to take action. We are seeing the world change. Traveling 300 years, where does my energy come from? These amazing young people, from little toddlers right through university students and visiting them in prisons and refugee camps, and it is really, really inspiring. Rootsandshoots.org will give you a wonderful idea of all the different things that are going on around the planet. You can also look up there about the giant peace doves. Giantpeacedove.org will find you, tell you how to make the doves. Out on our tables afterwards, we have little cards helping you to find that information. We want you guys to help us make lots of peace doves, so San Diego and on the beach and maybe on the sea, we can fly these beautiful doves and dream together about the peace which will never come unless we envision that it can. My next reason for hope is the resilience of nature. I already talked about the trees at Gombe that grow out of seemingly dead tree stumps. Rivers that have been polluted can be cleaned and restored. Forests, the redwood forests. I just spent 2 days with Mike Fay in the redwoods and saw how these trees won't die. And even if you cut down a giant tree and you leave the stump in time, the roots put up new saplings and eventually they will make a circle around the stump and join together to make another giant tree. They won't die. They will restore themselves. And animals on the brink of extinction can be given a second chance. Think of your California condor. There were 12 of them left at one time, and through the passionate dedication of some biologists who felt they could not allow this amazing creature to vanish. Now there's about 250-something condors flying in the skies above 4 states. Next reason for hope, the indomitable human spirit. And everywhere in all walks of life, there are people tackling seemingly impossible things who simply refuse to give up. They can be people like Nelson Mandela, who comes from 17 years of hard physical labor, 23 years in prison, with the amazing ability to forgive so that he led his nation out of the evil regime of apartheid without a bloodbath. People like Muhammad Yunus, who designed the Grameen Bank when all the other big banks laughed at him and told him it was impossible, and has now done probably more to help the poorest of the poor than anybody else. And then there are people just living all around us, living lives which, unless we know about them, we may just walk by and never know that we've walked past a person who's had to overcome seemingly impossible odds, physical disabilities, social problems, fleeing from a country, arriving with no money, no word of English, no friends, and somehow making a life for themselves and their families, struggling to survive, but go in, buy something from their store, and they'll smile at you. And if you learn their story, you can be amazed. So these are my very simple reasons for hope. But if we really think about the indomitable human spirit, if we think about the resilience of nature, if we think about the human brain, oh, I forgot the human brain, when it's attached to the human heart, is indeed an extraordinary mechanism. And we are now, we're feeling our backs to the wall, we are beginning to create technology that will help business to be more environmentally friendly. And we're using our brain to work out things like carbon trading, carbon credits. We're using our brain to work out how each one of us can walk through life with a smaller ecological footprint. All of these things together give me hope for the future. And I think, really and truly, there is an enormous amount of hope, but it lies with each one of us. We all have to do our bit. It isn't just going to happen. But I don't know if you feel it, but I do. I'm traveling 300 days a year around the world, and everywhere there are problems. But everywhere there are problems, I find a group of caring, compassionate, dedicated, courageous people who are working for little or no money, who are risking their health sometimes, risking losing their lives to try and put those problems right. And it's this which gives me the greatest hope. And perhaps, and I hope, at last, we're beginning to see the ice melting in the human heart. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.